Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. This week, my guest is Luke Harding. You may know Luke from his column at The Guardian, where he was once Moscow bureau chief, or his bestseller, Collusion, about Russia's influence on the 2016 election of Donald Trump. Today, I'll be speaking with Luke about his new book, Invasion, about the Russian war in Ukraine. If you like what you hear, please follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and tell your friends. Let's dive in. So, hey, where are you right now?
Hello. I'm just outside London in my family house, quite close to the flight path for Stansted Airport. So you may hear the odd rumble. And I'm going back to Ukraine in a couple of weeks. But for now, I'm just in the UK.
So you must feel like home whenever you feel airplanes flying low. You don't know whether you're in the middle of the night, you wake up, am I in a war zone or is it just the flat in London?
Yeah, it's been a very strange period, which we'll talk about, the whole invasion. So I have periods of manic activity in Ukraine, then I'm back in the UK. But strangely enough, actually, my brain is still very much in the Ukraine. So wherever I am, sort of physically, actually, my whole kind of mental cosmos is with the war and with the people who are suffering in the war.
You've made this book, Invasion, and really everything about Ukraine, so personal. I mean, what I really like about the book is that I feel that you are able to weave together the sort of geopolitical struggle and the war strategy along with the real suffering, hopes, and lives of the people you cover. But you're in there too. And so before I kind of get into the book, I'm trying to understand better how you even got involved in Eastern Europe, in Moscow in particular. All I could see really is that somehow when you're quite young, was it like 2007, you became Moscow bureau chief for The Guardian. Maybe you don't consider that quite young, but I think you were in your 30s at the time, no?
Yeah, I'd been knocking around by that point. I mean, I've been on The Guardian for about 25 years. And in 2000, I was sent to what was considered to be a relatively sort of sleepy posting, which was South Asia, based in Delhi, about a year before 9/11.
Oh,
so,
dear.
So I spent the next kind of few years in Afghanistan and then subsequently in Iraq, in Baghdad, and did all of George W. Bush's disastrous wars. And for a while, I was the sort of, I mean, I don't mean this to sound flippant, but I was the Guardian's war and death guy and roamed around, did natural disasters as well. And then in the summer of 2006, my then boss, by that point I was in Berlin, flew over for the World Cup, for the sort of soccer tournament, and said to me rather Delphically, "We think you need a bigger canvas." What she meant by that, it turned out, was that no one had actually applied for the Moscow job. It was kind of notoriously tough assignment, and it was go east, young man. So I literally started learning Russian the next day. I'd read classic Russian novels, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, but I was not
as one does.
I was not a Russian specialist, but I sort of thought, well, look, I'm up for an adventure. We're adaptable. My wife Phoebe, she's pretty cool. And you know, we had two sort of medium sized children, and we thought, well, look, we can do this. And then we pitched up in Moscow about a few weeks after this major international spy scandal, which you may or may not remember, involving Alexander Litvinenko, a Russian dissident who was poisoned in central London, just outside the US embassy, by two Kremlin goons with a radioactive cup of tea. And so I sort of arrived at there's this kind of peak Cold War moment, and pretty quickly found out that the regime of Vladimir Putin was a very dark one indeed.
Wow. I mean, I don't know what the metaphor is. It's not canary in the coal mine, but you're certainly a bellwether of trouble, I suppose, or just so happens. You know, it's your work that I think, writing for The Guardian and others, but a lot of yours, because I've gone back and looked at some of the stories, that made me so aware well before the election of Donald Trump that being concerned about his Russia ties was not what the far left said in our country. Oh, this is just red baiting, you know, that Putin was far from a communist and that, you know, that he had created this kleptocracy and that he was a murderer. And it's astonishing to me how few Americans understood that and even now don't fully get it. But before we get to that, so I'm kind of stunned that you learned Russian not that long ago, in 2006. How did you immerse to learn the language?
Well, I studied at Oxford. I studied English, not Russian. And I was briefly a sort of fellow there, journalism fellow at the Reuters Institute. And so I spent a term there as if I were a student in the language lab watching the Russian news. I had a teacher. And then when I shifted there, I got another teacher. And I have to say, it's the hardest thing, Jen, I ever did. I really worked it. I mean, bear in mind, no one really in Russia, apart from a few people in the elite, speaks English. So it's completely necessary. And also, actually, to understand the fabric of a country, how it thinks, you need to know how it speaks. Sure. So I worked at it with my teacher. After a year, I could sort of do it. By the end, I was fluent. And it was also, you know, I read Russian literature. I mean, obviously people like Chekhov, but yes, also lesser known writers like Bunin, who fled after the Bolshevik Revolution, wrote from exile, and other sort of Soviet writers of a couple of generations later who ended up in the United States, people like Dovlatov. I love that aspect of it. And for a long time in my head, I tried to make a distinction between the kind of evil regime, essentially, of Putin and the people around him, the power guys, the intelligence guys, and that kind of cultural, intellectual Russia. I'm not sure you can make that distinction anymore, but certainly I tried to do that when I was reporting from the country.
Yeah, I mean, since we're going to be name-dropping schools, I was an English major at a small school in Connecticut. You may have heard of it, New Haven. But I didn't study Russian there. I decided to study Mandarin Chinese, which is also quite difficult. And I kind of gave up after a while. But what I remember when I was in high school, there was a student at my prep school who was from Russia. And she told me that there was two different Russians, that what the children spoke and what the adults spoke, that the adults spoke a much more sophisticated language. But I suppose that's true in any country, but I was always struck by that. Is that true, do you find?
I'm not sure. I mean, my kind of daily task was perhaps a bit more banal. I would sort of sift through the newspapers, most of which were full of pro-Putin propaganda, and repeating the kind of tropes we've now become very familiar with, that the Kremlin was a victim of Western aggression, in particular American aggression and perfidiousness, that Russia was a kind of great country, a spiritual country, and increasingly, as we know, a country with great power aspirations beyond its borders. So I would sort of digest all this. I mean, back then, when I lasted for about 4 years in Moscow until I was kicked out in 2011.
Right. But so tell me about that.
Well, I was just going to say, but you know, back then it was a bit more plural. I mean, there was opposition media, which has now all been shut down. But essentially, you know, the brief version is that I found myself in a kind of pretty lousy spy thriller, way worse than John le Carré, where I had strange young men in black leather jackets following me around the icy streets of Moscow, where the British embassy advised me that our flat was bugged by the FSB, which is the successor agency to the KGB that Putin used to run. And we had a series of mysterious break-ins at the family apartment where these idiots would come in and just leave all sorts of dumb clues that they'd been in.
You wrote about that, right, in Collusion, maybe.
I mentioned it in Collusion. Actually, I wrote a sort of memoir come portrait of the Putin world after I got thrown out, called Mafia State.
Okay, maybe that's what I read. Yeah.
And you know, just to wrap up, I mean, why they kicked me out, I never really fully understood, but I think there were probably two reasons. One was I asked a kind of interesting question, which is, how much money does Vladimir Putin have? Answer, he's the richest person in the world, and he has everything. I mean, the state is his, effectively. And the other thing I did was to probe the murky behavior of the FSB spy agency. And I think in the end, that was too much for,
Going back to that question, when you said you asked it, did you do it the way like Bethany McLean asked, like, how does Enron make its money in a news story? Or did you actually ask a person in the Kremlin?
Well, both. I mean, okay. Talking to people in the Kremlin is very hard, but I talked to some sources back in 2007 who said that he was worth at least $40 billion, that his assets were held via offshore via a series of proxies and friends. And then subsequently, and there was particular, so a Swiss oil company called Gunvor, which everyone said belonged to him. Subsequently, the US Treasury Department sanctioned it. And we found out through the Panama Papers and other leaks, which I worked on for The Guardian with other people from, US journalists, German journalists, sure, that indeed there was this vast money trail going pretty much everywhere.
And you leave Russia in 2011, but somehow you make it to Ukraine in 2014, right around the time of the Maidan Revolution, or what's the English name for that?
The
Revolution of Dignity.
Or? Yeah, Revolution of Dignity.
That's, do you speak Ukrainian? Or like, how did you, so you go back to where, and then you end up in Ukraine and you learned Ukrainian, or do you bring a translator with you?
No, not quite. I mean, so I was covering Ukraine from Moscow. So I did a whole lot of trips there. And but that was when I met Paul Manafort in 2007, when he was acting advisor to Viktor Yanukovych, who was prime minister, then in 2010 became president. So I reported on Yanukovych's election victory, if you can call it that,
the jailing of
Yulia Tymoshenko, who was the opposition candidate.
Right.
And so I went to Ukraine a lot, including in 2014. But the point is that Ukraine, despite what the Kremlin says, you can speak Russian in Ukraine. Everyone speaks Russian. Ukrainians are bilingual. They speak Ukrainian and Russian. And I kind of understand Ukrainian. It's like listening to Russian with ear mufflers on in a bit of a blizzard. So I get sort of about half, two-thirds, but not all
of
it.
Is it like Portuguese to Spanish or something? Is it like if you speak Spanish, you can understand Italian or Portuguese?
I'm not that kind of Latin. I think perhaps a little bit further away than that. Basically, Russians don't understand Ukrainian, and Ukrainians understand both. And this cultural imbalance is one of the reasons we're in this disastrous situation.
So that makes that easier. So where were you if you're kicked out of Russia in 2011, but then you're reporting on Ukraine from where? I mean, you end up in Ukraine though.
I go back to London, and then I'm a kind of roving foreign correspondent. So I did other gigs as well. I did the Arab Spring. I was in Libya when Gaddafi was deposed. I did a few trips to Syria, but my focus really and my passion, or you might call it even an obsession, was with Russia. And I think just one quick thing to say was that when I was there, I came to a conclusion that other people reached much later, was that this was not merely a sort of domestically repressive regime that clubbed people over the head, opposition demonstrators and so on, and put them into wagons with bars on them, that this was actually a regime that was internationally aggressive and revisionist, that had designs on Europe, that was smoldering with perceived humiliation, and that wanted to completely sort of rework geopolitics,
sure,
so that Russia no longer lost the Cold War, but actually kind of was having another go and was going to win the Cold War second time around. And a lot of people, including in the US, were sort of slow to realize this transformation, where Putin was taking Russia, and that there was an assumption, including the Obama administration, that if you used reason, persuasion, logic, offered mutual solutions, were creative, and robust, that this would work. This was never going to work. Putin is basically the guy who wants to strangle you, across the table. And when you realize there's no point in talking to the strangler, you just need to stop the strangler from strangling you, you might get somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, this whole thing when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State under Obama and was going to like press that reset button that looked like one of those stupid red buttons from Staples. You know, the button?
I remember. And also, I mean, I've written about it, that the word reset was misspelled in Russian.
Oh, my goodness.
The Americans wrote recharge rather than reset, and as if you're recharging your mobile phone. And it spoke to the kind of low level of understanding, really analytical competence of the State Department at the time, and a degree of naivety. I mean, to be fair to the Obama team, they were not the only people who were naive about it. I mean, France and Germany have been very slow, really, yes. to realize.
And even recently,
what's going
you mentioned.
On.
You mentioned in your book, and I let's talk about before we zero in on the book, the context or the table you've set for us, which is, you know, in the mind of Vladimir Putin. I mean, none of us are really in his mind, but based on his external behavior and the things that he said, he is still holding a grudge. He does not, you know, he's trying to rewrite history or sort of rewind or restore Russia to maybe its imperial days. He's angry about the post-World War II agreements that set the national boundaries, and he doesn't like NATO or its expansion. And all the time, everything he's done has made that clear, including what he did. We could just go back to the annexation of Crimea. Well, even before that, that he, you know, getting his puppet like Yanukovych installed with Manafort's help, you know, the 2014 annexation of Crimea. The trying to get Trump installed and the interference in our election, the ongoing war on the border with Ukraine, the recent invasion. What makes it's all like, why do people, why are they searching for some kind of, why do people act like this is a fucking mystery? Like, I don't, it's like, the guy says, this is what I want. Oh, and he also, and also, I don't want anyone to stand up to my power and my money, so I will kill any, you know, dissidents if I can. Like, where's the fucking mystery, Luke? I mean, I know you're utterly brilliant reporter, and so I read you and what everyone else writes and what he says. So why does it? Why can't people see what's right in front of them? It's what is that?
I mean, it's a really interesting question. I think there are sort of several answers, but I'm just reminded of the height of the harassment against my family in Moscow when we were back there. I went back to London and I met a sort of senior official from the British Foreign Office, and he said in classic kind of Mandarin style, he said the problem with the Russians, by which he meant the Russian elite, is they don't think the way we think they should think. And that's the problem. They don't think the way we think they should think. They are, you know, Putin latterly, I mean, he's been obsessed with the Ukraine for a long time, has been, you know, I write in Invasion, I'd say he's been in what I call a strange and unreachable realm. He's not thinking about summits. He's not thinking about meetings with Joe Biden. He's got this shimmering vision before him of Russian greatness, and has decided that it's his messianic quasi-religious duty to restore the borders of what he considers to be historical Russia, which just so happens to include Ukraine and Belarus. So, so therefore, I mean, he wrote this essay, if you can call it that, which was published on the Kremlin website in the summer of 2021, which was a kind of tendentious romp through Russian-Ukrainian history, basically saying that they've always been a single, cogent, religious, spiritual, cultural, linguistic whole, and that various evil forces have divided Russia and Ukraine. The Mongols, remember those guys from the 13th century racing around the steppe? The Poles, who incorporated Ukraine into a Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. And then latterly, of course, the evil West, led by evil America, who have turned Ukraine, as he calls it, into what he calls an anti-Russian project. And what's so ridiculous, and this is another kind of idea which I think is worth exploring, is that Putin considers himself the author of nothing. He has no authorship. I mean, we're talking about books. You know, everything he does in his mind, the way it's presented on Russian state TV, is always delineated as an answer. There's even a word for it, an expression for it in Russian, which is a zerkalnaya advert, which means a mirror answer. So He does nothing bad. Bad things are done to Russia. Russia is therefore forced to respond. So the whole war, the whole invasion is not couched as an invasion. It's couched as a Russian response to an American provocation.
Right. Yeah, I mean, in his view, it's always nice if you're the aggressor to pretend you're a victim when you're trying to enlist people to do atrocious things in the name of your cause. Not the first time we've seen something like that. So, talking about the book, what I think is interesting is it mostly, if I've got this right, sort of the main narrative line is really about a 6-month period. I mean, you do dip back into pieces of history, but it seems to cover from just before the Russian invasion of Ukraine in January 2022 through late summer, maybe through August. Is that when you stopped writing?
No, not quite. I'd like to think it sort of it kind of begins in the 9th century when Kiev and Rus, this medieval city-state, began with Prince Vladimir back in 958. But we can take a more narrow time frame, if you prefer.
I mean, structure, though. When you think about, I think about books, because I write in nonfiction, I think there's like the top line narrative, which is like sort of the present, and then there's a place as you go back to explain. And to the extent that this book is structured as, I mean, you're in this book. I mean, you're writing it in first person, and maybe your first encounter, is it the spring of 2019 when you first meet with his team? I mean, I don't know, but it's not the current, the present day piece of this, the war. If it's the invasion begins in February of 2022, writing though. When did you have to put your pen down and they called time?
I had to put my pen down at the end of September 2022. Basically, I was there in 2019 reporting on Zelensky's election as Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky. Basically, I mean, just to explain, I mean, I was convinced, having done 4 years in Moscow, knowing these guys, that when Putin sent tanks, planes, fuel convoys to Ukraine's borders in the autumn of 2021, that meant a really large-scale military operation was coming, beyond the grinding eight-year war we'd seen in the east of the country in the Donbass. So I was doing these reporting trips from December of 2021 onwards. That month I was outside Donetsk with Ukrainian troops, got shot at by a Russian sniper just by the airport in this kind of gloomy forward position.
There's a lot of cities that are going through my head. Can you remind me geographically where that is?
Yeah, so the two key cities in the east, which have been run by Russian proxies since 2014, one is Donetsk and one is Luhansk. They're both Russian-speaking. And at that point, the Russians had about a third of Luhansk province and about a half of Donetsk. And Putin's goal is to capture all of that and indeed the rest. So I was there at the kind of the old war, if you can call it that. Yeah. And then when I was back in Kiev in January of last year, January 2022, the mood was pretty complacent. But the sort of experts and the sources I spoke to said, look, we don't think the Russians are going to do it, but one place that would be vulnerable if they do it is Mariupol, which is another eastern city run by Ukraine at that point on the Sea of Azov.
Right.
So I went to Mariupol as well. I made a film for The Guardian. I write about it. And then I drove all along what's now occupied territory to the border with Crimea, between Russian-occupied Crimea and Ukrainian forward positions there. And this stood me in good stead. I mean, the fact that I really felt an invasion was coming, and I'd done the miles, I think, helped with the book and helped with writing the book.
Let me just make sure I have the geography right. Mariupol is somehow an important area between the border of Russia and Crimea, which they've annexed, right on the water, on the sea. No, where's Mariupol?
You're sort of half right. It's on the Sea of Azov. So you've got the Black Sea, if you're looking at the map, on the left-hand side. Yeah. You've got the Sea of Azov on the right-hand side, which has now been turned into basically
Russian. When you say left and right-hand, because I, so we've got the sort of peninsula of Crimea, and if I'm staring at the map, on the left is the Black Sea, and in the right is, what was the name of the other sea?
Well, it's part of the Black Sea, but it's called the Sea of Azov, A-Z-O-V. And Mariupol is right, it's in Donetsk Oblast, sort of province, and it's about 25 kilometers from the proper Russian border. And of course, it was the first city to be swallowed up by this surging Russian invasion in February
and why is it of critical
March.
Importance? I mean, I understand why Putin would try to go for the places that were already kind of in contested space that had more Russian, non-Ukrainian Russian speakers. But what was particularly important strategically about Mariupol?
It's important because it was a humiliating moment last time round in 2014. I mean, I was there in 2014 for the first time, but basically the separatists backed, armed, funded, controlled by Russian military intelligence, briefly seized Mariupol and were kicked out. They were expelled by Ukrainians. And in the meantime, Ukraine turned Mariupol into this flourishing European city. There was a huge amount of investment. There's a port there. Lots of artists, entrepreneurs moved in. I mean, it was a lively place. And what's so poignant about it is and I write about this, is it's been wiped from the map. There were 400,000 people living there when I visited. Tens of thousands of them were killed by the Russians. Ugh. I mean, it's the greatest war crime of the century. It's just, I call it a charnel house. I mean, it's a house of the dead. It's now,
what
now
is that?
Kind of,
what is that word?
Charnel house. It's a sort of medieval word for a death pit. Mm. And I've been all over the world in my career. I've never been to a city that 4, 5, 6 weeks later ceases to exist, where people die of dehydration, of thirst, where there's no gas, there's no electricity, there's no water, where entire families cowering in their basements and they're wiped out by airdrop bombs. It's a horror. It's a horror.
And I was horrified by those personal stories. I was touched by, and I imagine you are still haunted by, Anatoly Loza. He was the person who started out being optimistic, and then he seemed terrified, and he asked you by phone, can you save my wife and children? And you had to say, I'm sorry. When did that happen? And I'm sorry to bring this up, but
yeah,
I don't know how you're still sitting or standing right now, or what medication you're on not to have nightmares.
No, I'm okay, but I mean, that was one of several kind of haunting episodes. Basically, I met Anatoly when as I said, when I visited Mariupol in January, and he was a patriotic military volunteer. He took me to the front line, the then front line. And we sort of sat and talked about Dostoevsky, and then we heard bangs and explosions, and we kept in touch. Nice guy. And
that's January.
That's January.
2022. So I just want to look here. 2022. Yeah,
January 2022. The Russians invade on February 24th.
Yes.
And then I call him about a week later, and he says, look, we're encircled. The Russians have brought their tanks up. Because at this point, they had swept up from Crimea all along the coast and sieged the city. But we're holding on. I mean, he sounded quite optimistic. Then he called me back about a week later and said, can you get my wife and kids out? When the situation by that point was entirely hopeless. And to be honest, Jen, I still feel guilty. I feel guilty because I was about 1,000 kilometers away on the other side of Ukraine. I mean, there was nothing I could do. I mean, what I said to him was, look, tell me what's going on. I'll write. All I can do is, you know, put this in the Guardian and bring Mariupol to the world's attention. You know, we are watching. We understand. We know. And the reason I just feel guilty is that, well, he then rang me a few days later, and he phoned me about midnight. At that point, it was almost impossible to get a phone signal in Mariupol. I think he was standing on a roof somewhere. And I could just hear the sound of the wind whipping off the Sea of Azov. There was just this kind of metallic noise and nothing. No voice, no person. Sort of disembodied, like a ghost. And then, of course, when Mariupol fell, I mean, these soldiers held
when
out.
When was that?
Was that
March?
It was in May.
Oh, my God.
So they hung on for about 3 months with a whole bunch of civilians living underground in these industrial catacombs. And by that point, there was a list of the people who died. It's a very, very long list of people who'd been buried in their yards, in the road, in vegetable plots, with makeshift signs scrawled in pen. And I just combed through the list to see if I could find him. I found children. I found old women. I found youths. I found just a whole heap of civilians who'd been murdered, basically, by the Russians. And I couldn't find him. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know what happened to his wife and kid. I suspect they survived. I mean, I don't know. He was lost. He was lost in the vortex.
But you can't feel guilty. I mean, I can't tell you not to feel guilty, but there's really, this is what you do. I mean, you can't save everybody, but getting this information out there, I think what you're doing is similar to what Joe Biden did, in that he saw it, he knew it, and he rallied the world. Because if he had not known the work you had done, people becoming aware of what Putin was really doing there meant that, other than places like, as you mentioned, France, that it was, for the most part, everyone believed and understood that Putin really was going to invade, and we weren't wrong-footed. We knew. I hate to bring up another, I'll get to something maybe more heartwarming, but since we're on the topic of atrocities, Bucha in March, and I think about Natasha and her nephew. Anyhow. I mean, if you can bear to honor her.
I mean, it's important. And this, in a way, is why I wrote the book, because I think, I mean, it's funny, isn't it? We think about storytelling, we think about narrative. We think, and actually normally with TV, you know, we're used to the grammar of TV. You watch TV news. And if there's, I mean, I've seen it, I've done it. You know, if there's an earthquake, you put the reporter in front of the worst affected building and you give the impression that it's all a bit terrible. Whereas the problem with Ukraine, this vast country of 40 million people, where there's a war being fought along a 1,300 kilometer front line, is that you can't encapsulate the horror in a TV report, and because it's just too big, it's too multifarious. And that's actually why I wrote the book, because I sort of felt one needed kind of a longer form to tell it. And Bucha, so just to explain Bucha, I mean, Bucha is a small, I almost want to say idyllic town. It's a satellite town of Kiev, about 30 kilometers to the northwest. It's very green. Mikhail Bulgakov, the Russian-Soviet writer, had a dacha there. He used to go there as a kid 100 years ago.
What's that word again? Dacha is like a summer house?
Dacha, yeah, D-A-C-H-A. It's a wooden summer house. And basically, the Russian war plan, what Putin assumed he'd be able to do was to send in troops from Belarus. So they started trundling past Chernobyl nuclear factory through these pine forests and swamps on the first day of invasion, February the 24th. And they kept going, and they got stuck in Bucha, just shy of Kiev. And they got destroyed, or some of them got destroyed, by Ukrainian artillery. And having initially, for the first 48 hours, been quite friendly to the civilian population, at that point they flipped. And they started taking it out on the people who were there. So they were executing men, they were raping women, and they were dumping bodies in the streets, that they were interrogating people in basements with their hands tied together. They were torturing them, burning them, electroshocking them.
And how did you know? I mean, how did you know this was happening? Who's telling you about this?
Well, so what happened was at the end of March, the very end of March of last year, 2022, it became clear to Putin and his generals that they had overreached, that they actually couldn't do Kiev. So they pulled out in this chaotic cavalcade back to Belarus. And that then, you know, we swept in, by which I mean, you know, the Ukrainian army, then prosecutors, then journalists, to see, you know, bodies and horror and Russian checkpoints. And a friend of mine, a Ukrainian friend of mine in Kiev called Alex, said, look, I've got a friend of mine called, who lives in Bucha, go and see her. So I went to go and see her. And she told me the story of her nephew, Volodya Cherednichenko, who was a 24-year-old guy. And what he did is a sort of classic mistake. He went to the center of Bucha after this Russian convoy had been smashed up, and he took photographs on his phone. And at that, briefly, the Russians were pushed out, then they came back again, and then they swept into his road, which was called Ivana Franka Street, named after a Ukrainian poet. And these soldiers went house to house, knocking on doors. You open the door, and they demanded to see everyone's phone, paperwork, etc. So Volodya handed over his phone, and they found the photos, and they just said, Tia Josh Snami, which means you're coming with us. And Tanya just sort of showed me what happened next, which is Volodya was walked off to this, marched off to this building, which the Russians were using as a temporary kind of base. And a couple of hours later, she shinned up the tree. She showed me the tree, peered over the green picket fence, saw that they'd broken his arm, that he was covered in blood, that he was sobbing, saying he didn't know anything. He didn't see anything. It was really cold. He was in flip-flops and T-shirt. And they managed to give him some warm clothes. And he was put in an armored personnel car and driven away. And the soldier said, look, you'll see him again. You'll see him again. And so for the next 3 weeks, they believed that Volodya was still alive. Then the Russians left. And we kept walking down the street. We turned right and found this abandoned house, which had been shot up. There were bullet holes in the door, daffodils, a dog kennel, a well. And there was this outbuilding. It was a cellar. And we descended the steps into the gloom. And at the bottom of the cellar was a bloody mattress and a purple children's toy. And the Russians had kept Volodya there for several days. And then one night, they had come down. It was locked, of course. He couldn't escape. He had no prospect of getting out. They came down, they made him kneel, and they shot him in the head. And so the Volodya's body was returned. I was shown the small little hole in the garden where he was buried amid the vegetables. And I went to see the mass grave in Bucha, where you could see feet sticking out of the earth with a training shoe. You could see the odd hand. I mean, Jen, I don't know if you've seen dead people, but they look like mannequins. Actually, they look sort of hyper real, not real, actually.
It's like the uncanny valley. It's very upsetting.
And just to wind up, there were 1,600 people, 1,600 civilians, some of them women, executed in the Kiev region. There were, you know, I've been to Izum in the northeast, looking at another mass grave there. I've been to Kherson. Basically, wherever the Russians occupy, they torture, they rape, they kill, they murder. That's what it means.
This is war. This is war.
Well, that's not war. I mean, that's genocide.
Well, this is genocide.
Mind.
I mean, sorry. It is genocide, but it is an unjust. These are not the rules of war to the extent that that's not an oxymoron. This is targeting civilians to try to break them, to take the territory without them there. There's something. I hope I didn't mistake her name. I called her Natasha, but you said Tanya. Is that the same?
Yeah, it's the same. Yeah, Natasha is
a nickname.
Full name.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, so
someone, I don't know who said this. I made a note of this. Someone said to you, "People can get used to anything." Is that true?
Well, I mean, I don't think people can get used to that their relatives being abducted and killed. I mean, I think what that person meant was that people can get used to living in conditions of war, where you hear the boom of artillery, you know, often outgoing as well as incoming. Incoming, that's one thing you learn quickly as a war correspondent. Incoming, it's a whistle. You hear the whistle, you're in trouble. You hear the boom, you're okay. And if there's a whistle and the ground vibrates, then you're in real trouble. But Grad missiles, I mean, so people live in extraordinary situations. A lot of people, I spent a lot of time on the front line in 2022. Most people leave, especially families, but not everyone does. And old people, and you heard it here first, turn out to be quite stubborn.
Myself heading in that direction.
The number of conversations I've had with women who say, "I would go, but my elderly father refuses to leave." Or people with pets say, "Look, I would go, but I can't because of the cats." And actually, you know, guys, the Russians are 5 kilometers away. There are shells pouring in. Your city is 60% ruined. It's time to go. And yet they won't
go. Let's talk about stubborn and, the hero of the book. Hero is maybe the wrong word, but he's kind of a hero of this era is Vladimir Zelensky.
Yeah.
And I learned some new things in your book about him. I mean, I knew he had been a brilliant comedian, and then he starred in this program, Servant of the People, where he becomes, in the TV show, president of Ukraine. And what I didn't know, though, is when he decided to run for office— against, is it Poroshenko, or he started his own political party, Zelensky did, called Servant of the People Party. One of your colleagues dubbed him Churchill with an iPhone, and I think that's perfect. But I wonder, you know, he must have foreseen how brutal this would be, and yet he had the courage, and has the courage, when we're almost a year into this thing, to stand tough. When he said... I'm trying to think. In Ukrainian, I'm here. What is
Yatut.
That? How do you say that?
Yatut.
I love that. And Yatut. My goodness, talk about courage. Is he kind of a miracle person? What do you've met him? Tell me about what you think about his leadership.
Full disclosure, I'm still awaiting the exclusive interview. I mean, I've sort of interacted with him at press conferences and asked him questions, but I haven't shaken his hand yet. I think I will probably this year. What you have to bear in mind is that he was already a famous guy, but he was famous as an entertainer. I mean, he won Ukraine's Dancing with the Stars in a bolero suit. I mean, he can dance. He was funny. He did sketches. He was quick. He's quite a
kind of like John Stewart, if John Stewart could dance.
Yeah, he's quite a slight figure as well. I mean, he's not super tall. And then he decided he was going to go into politics. But the sort of serious point is that he ran as the peace candidate. He said, uh-huh. you know, Poroshenko was a more hawkish sort of figure. And he said, no, I will sit down with Vladimir Putin. I will end the war in the East and I will restore stability and good modern government. That's what he promised. And of course, what he quickly realized was, I mean, there was the odd prisoner exchange with Putin, but he quickly realized the Russians were not interested in peace. They just wanted to smash Ukraine. Ukrainian soldiers were still being shot. When I was there in January of 2022, there was still a faint air of denialism from the Zelensky team. I mean, he was talking down the prospect of invasion at the same time that Biden people were talking it up.
But which way was it? I mean, you kind of intimate that he was doing that so that people wouldn't flee and so that he could still get support? Or do you think he was still in denial, really?
I think it was a bit of both. I mean, he didn't want people to panic, but on the eve of invasion, you'd walk around Kiev, and Kiev was, the restaurants were full, there were no sandbags, everything was functioning as normal.
And you were there? Were you there on the 24th?
I was there. I was there all the way through. Yeah. My book Invasion it begins with a dinner party.
Oh, that's right. I'm remembering
with
now.
Andrei Kukhov, the Ukrainian novelist, and
right.
So
and weren't you running late? And you bought a bottle of wine
or something?
Yeah,
bought wine from Odessa. You know, because I had to file, and then we ate borscht. And you know, Kukhov, who's this wonderful ebullient figure. In fact, he's in the US on book tour. Soon, I think next week. I think he's on the West Coast. He was this great gregarious host, and he looks sort of bit bear-like. I mean, he has the mind of Voltaire, but he looks quite burly. I was saying, look, Andrea, I really think it's going to happen. And he had filled his kind of car with gas just in case, but I think he didn't really believe it either, like most Ukrainians. And then after this wonderful dinner, we embraced, I said goodbye to his British wife, Elizabeth. And then I went out into the street and looked at this dark velvet sky. And I took a call from a Ukrainian contact who'd been in the foreign ministry. He just said, it's happening at 4 a.m. It's happening at 4 a.m. And sure enough, it did. It happened about half an hour later. So I was there for all of that. But I think what I try and capture in the book is the transformation. So Zelensky, who was a little bit behind the curve of history, and his poll ratings had started to kind of sink, actually. And then the war happens, and he uses all of the skills that he has as an actor to reassure Ukrainians, to amplify what they're thinking. He you know, that iPhone address that he did on sort of day three, where he says yatut 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 yatut. Basically, yeah. the Putin was convinced that Zelensky was an American puppet who would flee, that he would run away to the US, and within 4 weeks he would pop up. You know, he'd be on CNN, then he'd pop up giving, you know, talks at Harvard or whatever, and that would be the end of Zelensky. Right. He'd be on the lecture circuit.
At a Kennedy school,
he'd be at the Kennedy school.
Sorry, a lot of my friends are there.
That didn't
offense.
Happen. I mean, he stayed.
He
stayed.
I mean, that's incredible.
He stayed, and I think I said, you know, Churchill with an iPhone, I think is apt. I mean, if you look at his address to both houses of Congress, it's incredibly moving. Ago, where he's talking about Pearl Harbor, he's talking about 9/11. If you look at the address he gave to the British Houses of Parliament on day 13, where he invokes Shakespeare. And then he actually uses Churchill's most famous speech, but he tweaks it slightly. So he says, you know, we will fight them on the beaches. We will never surrender. And then he Ukrainizes this thing, and he says, we will fight them in the forests. We will fight them in the rivers. We will fight them on the Kalmius, which is this river that flows through Mariupol. We will fight them on the slag heaps. He's referring to Donbass. We will never surrender. And then he says, he talks about Veliki Britannia, which means Great Britain, and Veliki Ukraina, which is sort of Great Ukraine. And it's like, I mean, I write it's like an incantation. He's magically binding these two countries together, shared destinies, shared suffering, shared historical memory. What he does and his team do, I mean, I tracked down and spoke to a speechwriter. I was the first person to do that, is they understand narrative. I mean, your listeners understand it. They understand the importance of storytelling.
Yes.
And they've portrayed this war correctly, I think, as good versus evil, as if it's Lord of the Rings. And actually, the strange thing is you'll talk to Ukrainian old ladies and they will refer to Russian soldiers as orcs. It kind of works. I mean, the Russians are orcs. Moscow is Mordor. Putin is Sauron. And the Ukrainians are fighting this very existential battle to survive for their right to be, to live, to be free.
The Hearts and Minds campaign here, in part not just because he was a performer, but not an ordinary performer. Comedians write their own work. They're keen observers of the culture. But he ran media companies. They were very good on social media. I took a course recently, graduate school course online. A friend of mine taught called Shakespeare and Political Spectacle. And I think the speeches that he's given are truly in line with some of the best writing and sort of political theater. And I don't mean to, when I say theater, I say that with respect. I don't say it as if in the way that someone might discount something as being surface. I think you have to be that person. And I wonder if we compare, I think about Donald Trump, who was created through The Apprentice, right? I think we have Zelensky, who is more of a self-made person. I mean, certainly he didn't provide his own funding. We're not really sure where all of that. I mean, he's got to get support from elsewhere, but he brings with him a persona. Same thing with when Manafort had to create the persona that would be palatable out of, why am I spacing on his name?
Viktor Yanukovych.
Yeah, Yanukovych. And I wonder if we just have to all, kind of like you were saying before, people say, well, Putin's just not thinking the way you want him to. I think sometimes people who are political purists who think it's, you know, distasteful to recognize charisma or theater around leadership are very naive because, as my friend who teaches this course, Linda Sharns, talks about, these ideas of structures of feeling. And you really need to have people feel a certain way. And this is going to bring me to one of the biggest memes from the war that holds so much, which was what happened on Snake Island. And can you remind me a bit of this and actually tell me whether you have some coffee packets that actually have the phrase on it?
Jen, we are allowed to swear in your esteemed podcast, aren't we?
We are R-rated, or yes, yeah, R-rated is okay. Where we go.
I don't want to offend any minors who may
be listening. No, it's all right.
The importance of the Snake Island story, I mean, so basically the Snake Island is I don't think there are any snakes on it, although there were mythologically. It's a smallish island which looks like a flounder, dropped from the heavens into the north west Black Sea. And it's a strategic point. And essentially, it was an obvious Russian target. And the Russians sent in, the big mob to capture it on the very morning of the invasion. And there were about 50 Ukrainian soldiers there and a small platoon of about 20
on. So it's February 24th.
February 24th. And so they start bombarding it. There's one Russian frigate that comes into view. And then by about lunchtime, after a lot of bombardments already, the Moskva, which is the Russian flagship, it's almost 500 meters long. I describe it as a sort of shark that can kind of mince everything in its path. But basically, the reason I know all this is because I talked to Bogdan, who was the head of the Border Guard platoon, who gave me a kind of vivid account of what had happened. But the Moskva radioed to the Snake Island transmission tower, and this portentous voice came on saying, this is the Moskva, this is Russian warship, surrender, lay down your arms, or we will be forced to destroy you. And then there's this kind of murmured conversation in the background, weary in tone. And then the guy who's got the microphone in front of him, after discussion, just says, Russian warship, go fuck yourself, and hangs up. These five words, that they went on this what I call a sort of galactic journey. I mean, because basically everyone assumed that then they seized the island. These Russian commandos scaled up its cliffs, took everyone away, dumped them on a boat and took them back to occupy Crimea. And the assumption was for the first sort of 2-3 days they'd all died heroic martyrs' deaths, that they'd all been killed in combat.
Not begging and crying, but saying, go fuck yourself.
But saying, go fuck yourself,
it's
like a big V sign to Putin and to the Russians who, as always, had behaved with overweening arrogance and odiousness. So this phrase, fuck off Russian warship, it sort of went everywhere. And what is so great, I mean, I really enjoyed writing this chapter, is just what happened next. And what happened next was that this Ukrainian-American called Igor, who runs the Ukrainian Postal Service, thought, okay, this is now a national slogan, I will issue a stamp. So he issues a stamp on April the 12th, which shows the silhouette of a Ukrainian serviceman doing the finger to the warship in the background. And 2 days, the Moskva. 2 days later, the Ukrainians sink the Moskva using these secret Neptune missiles, and it fucks off to the bottom of the ocean. I mean,
I'm sorry, it's just it's so grimly funny. Brilliant.
And it just everybody. What you have to understand is everyone assumed the Ukrainians would fall, that Ukraine would fall, that Zelensky
within
would fall,
days or weeks,
that it was all over, that no one could stand up to the mighty Russian army, the mighty Putin, etc. And in fact, what we've seen and what I write about is this incredible fight back. I mean, they've been brave, they've been resilient, they've been humorous, and most of all, they've been networked. Ukraine is this horizontal society where everybody is working in some capacity towards victory, whether it's old women making, you know, knitting camouflage nets, or students fixing...
Wait, stop. I'm a big knitter. Old women are knitting camouflage nets?
Yeah, they are, while singing patriotic songs and making borscht. And students are fixing Molotov cocktails. And plenty of people who've got no military experience have volunteered to fight with the army. And many of them have died. Look, this isn't Hollywood. I mean, people are dying in squalid circumstances. But the point is, Ukrainians are determined to win. I think on some level they have won, insofar as they've proven to the world they are a state, they are a people, they are a nation. They are deserving of our respect, of our kindness, of our empathy, of our military support. And I would say, I don't want to inject a sort of partisan note on this, but this is true of Democrats and Republicans, and it has been largely bipartisan in the US. But there is a certain worrying tendency on the Trumpian right to side with Russia and the Kremlin, which, to my mind, as someone who's reported from Ukraine and seen what's going on there, strikes me as nothing less than abhorrent.
So as we start to wind to a close, I've got three questions that all begin with the word what for you.
Okay.
Some may take longer than others. First is, what kind of borscht did you have on the night before the invasion? Was it beet or was it cabbage borscht?
It was beetroot borscht. And consumed
hot or cold?
Hot, served in a ceramic bowl and with zakuski, which it's basically pork fat. And honey vodka. So you have a shot of vodka, you have a bit of pork fat, you have a bit of bread, and you have some borscht, or very quickly, Jen, your life feels a lot better than
but you
about
don't
20
do
minutes
no
before.
Sour cream, no sour cream in the borscht.
Well, I didn't. I mean, you can. I don't think. I mean, I'm not a borscht literalist. I think people can have borscht whatever.
Yes.
I mean, we did have a big debate about how to spell it. By the way, the Ukrainian spelling, if you transliterate the Ukrainian spelling in English, it's B-O-R-S-C-H, S-C-H. Whereas the normal Anglo-American spelling is B-O-R-S-H-T.
Yes.
But anyway, you know, to be discussed.
What if Trump had won the election in 2020? Well, would he have gotten rid of NATO? What would have happened to Ukraine, do you think?
Well, I think Putin would definitely have invaded. I think it would have been much harder for the Ukrainians to have hung on. I mean, it's a counterfactual. Would Kiev have fallen? I think probably not, even without American help. What you can say for sure is that Ukraine would not have been able to take back the territory that we've seen. These counteroffensives, which I've covered in the autumn in the northeast around Kharkiv, the recapture of the city of Kherson on November 11th, 2022, would not have been possible if Donald Trump had been there. I think he may have left NATO. And I think if I, in this sort of parallel world, I was sitting in the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, I would be extremely nervous because it's clear that Putin wants to re-annex them next. He wants to hook up Russia with this little exclave called Kaliningrad, which is part of Russia, but is separated from Russia. And the way he would do that would be by seizing Lithuanian territory. So it's definitely on the to-do list. If Trump comes back, I think all those things are back in play.
My final what is kind of a what now with this in mind. Someone you interviewed said, Russia is like a monkey with a grenade. As we're recording this, Putin has called for a ceasefire, whether that will hold or not, during Orthodox Christmas here in January. But what now? How does this war end? Does it ever end?
Yeah, just on the ceasefire, to be clear, if Putin says something, that generally means it's not true. So I don't think the ceasefire is a ceasefire. I think it's just a sort of PR gesture following a series of reversals on the battlefield. Going forward, I think we're in a grinding phase of the war. I mean, I would expect the Ukrainians to try and seize back more territory in the spring. So possibly around Melitopol, which is an occupied city in the Zaporizhia province, that would be a kind of obvious place to push, maybe from Kherson across the Dnieper River towards Crimea. I think retaking territory in the east is going to be harder. But what we're sort of seeing the Ukrainians do is what they've been doing all along, is just being smart, playing smart, destroying in a very clinical way Russian logistics centers, fuel dumps, barracks, mm-hmm. and so on, so they can go forward. But at the same time, Putin is doubling down. He's mobilizing even more men. He seems to think in his sociopathic way that he can win this war. And of course, he doesn't care how many Russians are killed. We think more than 100,000 so far have been killed and injured. He doesn't care. So my prediction, unfortunately, and I'm pretty confident in this, is the war will continue up until the summer and beyond. But I do think momentum is with Ukraine. And I think eventually, I don't know how long eventually means, I think the Ukrainians will prevail. And, you know, that whether they'll get everything back, I don't know. But I think the Ukraine essentially will win.
Between now and then, do you think he's going to provoke NATO and we're going to all be involved?
No, I don't. I mean, what you have to understand about Putin is that he's a coward. He's a coward. I mean, look at the image of him at a 20-meter-long table sitting at one end. You know, that's right. The defining image of the last year.
But he sat next to those threatening nurses or something.
No, he didn't. I mean, it's all kind of
pilots.
Montage.
I know.
It's all montage.
It was,
it's all fake.
Oh, really? That wasn't real?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, nothing is real.
I'm joking. They weren't threatening. I mean, they weren't, yes.
So he's a coward. And the reality is that America could kind of crush Russia very quickly. And everyone knows that now. I mean, the Russians have failed to take Ukraine. They thought they could. They've fallen short. So he's not going to pick a fight with NATO. He's not going to use nuclear weapons either. I mean, that's not going to happen. Because Putin cares about power and he cares about his personal survival. I mean, in the words of Alexei Navalny, Russian opposition leader, poisoned, now in jail. He's a cowardly little man in a bunker. And once you understand that, things fall into place.
Well, thank you so much. Is there any thing you think I left out that you wanted to talk about?
No, I mean, just to say it's been a delightful discussion. I really enjoyed it. And for me, actually, too, on some level, it's also therapy, strangely enough, to talk about all this. So thank you for my therapy session. I really enjoyed it.
Of course. And how can people find you if they're looking for you besides buying your book, Invasion?
Well, they can find me on Twitter, Luke Harding 1968. I kind of hate it. I love hate it. I think it's still, unfortunately, indispensable if you're a journalist, especially in a war zone. And they can read The Guardian, which is free and progressive. And hey, you know, we tell the truth. That may seem an old fashioned concept, but I believe not in many truths. I believe in the truth. So yeah, read The Guardian, read my book. Thank you.
Well, lovely. Great speaking with you.
Thanks very much, Jen.
I was so moved by that interview. I honestly don't know how Luke sleeps at night. That sounds like the wrong thing to say, but I admire the work he is doing, and I don't know that I would have the strength to report in a war zone, but so glad that there are incredible journalists who are willing to do this work and who really do care about the people that they cover. I really do hope that he gets an opportunity to meet one-on-one with Vladimir Zelensky. And maybe when the paperback of Invasion comes out, he can include that in the new edition. I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. And please let us know what you think. What are you reading? I want to know. Send an email to me at bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write to us at bookedup at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast.